Good morning. You are listening to Lowell Association of the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Barry, and I'll be reading to you today from the Lowell Sun and maybe later from the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. I hope you're doing well today. A lot of national news in the Sun today, it looks like. The top story on Thursday, January 8th, by Peter Currier from the Lowell Sun, is "This needs to be brought to Congress. Democrat lawmakers push to reassert congressional war powers." A group of a dozen Democratic veteran members of the House of Representatives on Wednesday called for Congress to reassert its power to authorize war amid U.S. intervention in Venezuela and possibly beyond. The Democratic lawmakers, led by Massachusetts 6th Congressional District Representative Seth Moulton and New York 18th Congressional District Representative Pat Ryan, spoke to the media following a briefing by the Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Defense Secretary Peter Hegseth on the situation in Venezuela, where U.S. forces captured President Nicolas Maduro in a Saturday raid. The rest of Maduro's regime remains in power in Venezuela, and it is unclear whether further U.S. military actions may be imminent. Moulton, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran who served in the war in Iraq, compared the situation in Venezuela to that war and recalled the different feelings he experienced at each stage of it. As an Iraq veteran, as an Iraq war veteran myself, I remember that what it was like when the invasion went so well and how proud of my Marines I was. I remember what it was like when the president said, "Mission accomplished," said Moulton. I remember what it was like when it turned out the Bush administration lied to us about the intelligence and their intentions and kept changing their story about why we went to war in the first place. I remember what it was like when it became apparent the administration had no plan for what comes next. And I remember what it was like when the Bush administration presided over a disaster in Iraq, Moulton continued. I remember what the aftermath of that was like as more and more Americans died in a forever war and the country descended into civil war and chaos. That is why I'm skeptical of what is going on in Venezuela today. Moulton says he does not believe, Moulton says he does believe Maduro to be a bad guy, but that the American people should not be lied to about why the country is getting involved in the war. Maduro has been in power in Venezuela since the death of Hugo Chavez in 2013 and has employed an increasingly authoritarian rule to remain in power. The 2024 presidential election in Venezuela is widely believed to have been rigged in Maduro's favor, with opposition candidate Edmundo González being found to have taken the most votes per review of the voting receipts. The operation was successful, of course, it was, because that is what America does, said Moulton, referring to Maduro's capture. But we as members of Congress and the American people should not be lied to by any administration, and we should all ask the question about whether our tax dollars, about where our tax dollars and where American lives may be spent or wasted next. Speaking after Moulton, Ryan said Rubio and Hegseth lied to our faces when they claimed last month there was no goal of regime change or land attacks on Venezuela, and that the Trump administration would come to Congress before doing anything. The only moment of honesty this whole time was when Donald Trump that morning said this was about oil, said Ryan. The lawmakers had just attended a briefing by Rubio, who Ryan said displayed a refusal to answer any substantive questions. Responding to questions from reporters, Ryan noted that a series of war powers resolutions have been introduced in Congress, including one introduced by Massachusetts 2nd Congressional District Representative Jim McGovern that failed by one vote before the new year. There is a plan, Ryan said, to introduce more legislation to make clear that we will not fund another forever war in the United States of America on our watch. A vote on a new form of that legislation is expected to take place first in the Senate Thursday, with a bill aiming at prohibiting Trump from further military action in Venezuela without congressional approval. Massachusetts 3rd Congressional District Representative Lori Trahan sat down with the Sun Tuesday morning in Lowell when she said, "Nobody is denying the fact that Maduro was a horrible, illegitimate, repressive, undemocratic leader of Venezuela. Venezuelan Americans, they are celebrating. The problem right now is that there is no plan. Secretary of War Hegseth has been talking about how this has been about drugs. Right after the attack, Secretary of State Rubio talked about this being about regime change. And in the president's address for the country, he intimated it was about taking over the country, taking over the oil, said Trahan. I think now is a good time for congressional Republicans to say this is worthy of debate. This is worthy of the president laying the case out to the American people, us as representatives, being open to debating that in a very transparent way and holding this administration accountable, she said. Trahan and the lawmakers at Wednesday's press conference questioned the actual monetary cost of the operation and potential future operations in South America. So what is the plan? Are we running the Venezuelan government? This is not something the president gets to decide on his own or with Stephen Miller. This needs to be brought to Congress so it can be debated, said Trahan. Well, we are on that. And on page two here, there is another story on Venezuela. United States seeks to assert control over Venezuelan oil. Tankers and sales worldwide are targeted. This is from the Associated Press. President Donald Trump's administration on Wednesday sought to assert its control over Venezuelan oil, seizing a pair of sanctioned tankers transporting petroleum and announcing plans to relax some sanctions so the U.S. can oversee the sale of Venezuela's petroleum worldwide. Trump's administration intends to control the distribution of Venezuela's oil products globally following its ouster of President Nicolas Maduro in a surprise nighttime raid. Besides the United States enforcing an existing oil embargo, the Energy Department says the only oil transported in and out of Venezuela will be through approved channels consistent with U.S. law and national security interests. The level of control over the world's largest proven reserves of crude oil could give Trump's administration a broader hold on oil supplies globally in ways that could enable it to influence prices. Both moves reflect the Republican administration's determination to make good on its efforts to control the next steps in Venezuela through its vast oil resources after Trump has pledged the U.S. will run the country. Vice President J.D. Vance said in an interview, the U.S. can control Venezuela's purse strings by dictating where its oil can be sold. We control the energy resources, and we tell the regime, you're allowed to sell the oil so long as you serve America's national interests, Vance said in an interview to air on Fox News Channel's Jesse Waters Prime Time. Vice President added, and that's how we assert incredible pressure on that country without wasting a single American life. Secretary of State Marco Rubio suggested the oil taken from the sanctioned vessels seized in the North Atlantic and Caribbean would be sold as part the deal announced by Trump on Tuesday, under which Venezuela would provide up to 50 million barrels of oil to the U.S. Venezuela's interim authorities want that oil that was seized to be part of this deal, Rubio told reporters after briefing lawmakers Wednesday about the Maduro operation. They understand the only way they can move oil and generate revenue and not have economic collapse is if they cooperate and work with the United States. Seizing two more vessels, U.S. European command said on social media that the merchant vessel Bella One was seized in North Atlantic for violation of U.S. sanctions. The U.S. has been pursuing the tanker since last month after it tried to evade a blockade on sanctioned oil vessels out around Venezuela. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem revealed U.S. forces also took control of the M. Sophia in the Caribbean Sea. Noem said on social media that both ships were either last docked in Venezuela or en route to it. The two ships join at least two others that were taken by U.S. forces last month, the Skipper and the Centuries. The Bella One had been cruising across the Atlantic nearing the Caribbean on December 15th when it abruptly turned and headed north towards Europe. The change in direction came days after the first U.S. tanker seizure of a ship on December 10th after it left Venezuela carrying oil. When the U.S. Coast Guard tried to board the Bella One, it fled. U.S. European command said a Coast Guard vessel had tracked the ship pursuant to a warrant issued by a U.S. federal court. As the U.S. pursued it, the Bella One was renamed Marinera and flagged to Russia. Shipping databases show. A U.S. official who spoke on the conditions of anonymity to discuss sensitive military operations said the ship's crew had painted a Russian flag on the side of the hull. The Russian Foreign Ministry said it had information about Russian nationals among the Marinera's crew in a statement carried by Russian state news agencies TASS and RIA Novosti, demanded that the American side ensure humane and dignified treatment of them, strictly respect their rights and interests, and not hinder their speedy return to their homeland. Separately, a senior Russian lawmaker, Andrei Klyas, described the U.S. action as blatant piracy. The Justice Department is investigating crew members of the Bella One vessel for failing to obey Coast Guard orders, and criminal charges will be pursued against all culpable actors, Attorney General Pam Bondi said. The Department of Justice is monitoring several other vessels for similar enforcement action. Anyone on any vessel who fails to obey instructions of the Coast Guard or other federal officials will be investigated and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, Bondi said. The ship had been sanctioned by the United States in 2024 on allegations of smuggling cargo for a company linked to Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, which is backed by Iran. The Trump administration, meanwhile, is selectively removing sanctions to enable the shipping and sale of Venezuelan oil to markets worldwide, according to a outline of policy published Wednesday by the Energy Department. Sales are slated to begin immediately with 30 million to 50 million barrels of oil. The U.S. government said the sales will continue indefinitely, with the proceeds settling in U.S.-controlled accounts at globally recognized banks. The money would be dispersed to the U.S. and Venezuelan populations at the discretion of the Trump government. Venezuelan state-owned oil company PDVSA said it is in negotiations with the U.S. government for the sale of crude oil. This process is developed under schemes similar to those in force with international companies, such as Chevron, and is based on a strictly commercial transaction with criteria of legality, transparency, and benefit for both parties, said the company in a statement. The U.S. plans to authorize the importation of oil field equipment, parts, and services to increase Venezuela's oil production, which has been roughly 1 million barrels a day. The Trump administration has indicated it also will invest in the electrical grid to increase production and the quality of life for people in Venezuela, whose economy has been unraveling amid changes to foreign aid, cuts to state subsidies, making necessities, including food, unaffordable to millions. Noem said both seized ships were part of a shadow fleet of rusting oil tankers that smuggle oil for countries facing sanctions such as Venezuela, Russia, and Iran. After the seizure of the now-named Marinara, which open-source maritime tracking sites showed was between Scotland and Iceland earlier Wednesday, the UK Defense Ministry said Britain's military provided support, including surveillance aircraft. Back to the front page. Cost of living. State forecasts lower winter heating bills for most homes. Natural gas, heating oil, and propane prices are expected to decrease. By Colin Young. As an investigation of utility bill cost drivers gets underway, state government has projected that about three-quarters of Massachusetts homes could spend between 4 and 9% less than last year on heating this winter. This combination of a slightly milder winter and the expectation of lower fuel costs spells good news for natural gas, heating, oil, and propane customers at a time when utility expenses are top of mind for residents. But the Department of Energy's resources household heating cost estimate envisions a cost increase of about 6% for homes that use electric baseboard heating due to higher electricity prices this winter. Although heating oil, propane, and natural gas prices are expected to be lower compared to last year, many households will still spend more overall because extended periods of cold weather lead to more heating use, Door cautioned in its winter heating forecast. For example, last winter was colder than initially forecasted, which contributed to higher heating bills. The forecast was published in November, and colder weather since then will influence actual heating bills. Natural gas is the most common heating fuel in Massachusetts, serving about half of all homes. Retail gas rates are approved by the Department of Public Utilities for each heating season beginning November 1st. Based on the utility's rate filings, DOER said it expects retail natural gas prices to average about $2.03 per therm this winter, down from $2.24 last year. The average home heated by natural gas is estimated to consume 435 therms for space heating, Doerr said, putting the average estimated cost for heating this winter at $883, down 9.3% from last year. Heating oil keeps about 20% of Massachusetts homes warm in the winter, especially older homes and those in rural areas. DOER estimated that retail heating oil in Massachusetts will average $3.10 per gallon this year, down from $3.43 a gallon a year ago. As a result, the average household using heating oil can expect winter bills to total about $1,103, about 8% or $102 lower than last year, DOER said. The 4% of homes that heat with propane also stand to see lower costs this winter based on projected average price of $3.17 per gallon compared to $3.33 per gallon last winter, DOER said. The average propane heated household can expect winter bills to be about $1,412, 4% or $51 lower than last year, the department said. For the roughly 20% of homes that heat with electricity, DOER estimated a winter heating expenditure of $898. That's up 6.4% from last winter, in part due to DOER's expectation that the statewide average electric utility rate will be about 35 cents per kilowatt hour compared to last year's rate of 33 cents. High energy prices and recent volatility have exacerbated chronic cost of living pressures for Bay State residents and businesses that already pay some of the highest energy prices in the country. The issue has also called attention to the state clean energy and climate mandates that some say are driving elevated costs. The DPU in mid-December opened an investigation of all delivery charges on electric and gas bills in Massachusetts, laying out a goal to examine the causes of bill volatility and promote a greater understanding of rates for customers to take greater control over their energy bills. It's a review that Governor Maura Healey asked for 9 weeks earlier when she said the state must act with just incredible urgency to do everything we can do to lower costs. The first phase of the investigation is focused on a review of charges and fees, but the DPU said a second phase will zero in on making it easier for ratepayers to understand what they are being charged for and why. The complexity of current utility bills increases customer confusion and mistrust and may reduce customers' sense of empowerment to reduce their energy bills by changing how they use energy, DPU commissioner said. Add that the department frequently hears such complaints from taxpayers. Former Boston Red Sox player and broadcaster Lou Maloney took to the X platform Monday evening to lodge his own complaint. What the hell is going on with gas bills? 2/3 of my bill is, I don't know what. Can't wait for January's. Holy Healy. Others have shared their thoughts directly with the DPU as part of its formal investigation. A resident of Granby, Timothy Wright, told commissioners that he has serious concerns about dramatically increasing delivery charges as well as the increasing complexity of our utility bill. Our most recent national grid bill includes approximately 10 separate delivery-related line items, which makes it nearly impossible for the average consumer to understand what we are actually paying for and why costs are increasing so rapidly. Transparency is essential for trust, and right now the billing structure feels confusing, opaque, and discouraging, Wright wrote to the DPU. The DPU got its first feedback from a ratepayer the day after it launched its investigation. A person only identified as Nelson T said they spent $6,000 on gas and electricity in 2025 compared to $3,000 a few years ago, and that it's pushing them to consider leaving the state. My pay increase isn't keeping up with the expenses that I am ready to move out of the state. My kids will graduate with student debt. How can they ever afford to pay down the debt and save money with the crazy cost of utilities added onto their monthly costs? Person wrote in an email. I never thought I would ever say I would move out of Massachusetts. This is the state I grew up in and my kids also. But the costs reside in Massachusetts has gone through the roof. On Wednesday, groups including the Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities, MassCap, Action for Boston Community Development, and others will hold a briefing to raise awareness of the state's Home Energy Assistance Program. Funded by the EOHLC and administered by a network of 20 community organizations, the HEAP program includes both heating assistance and energy efficiency and weatherization program. And the last story on the front page is from Lowell. Kayak launch project out to bid. Project features inaccessible launch ramp. Nearly a year after its approval by the Conservation Commission, and after blowing through its expected fall 2025 opening, the Muldoon Park Kayak Launch Project in South Lowell finally went out to bid. The Americans with Disabilities Act compliant gangway and dock float was waiting on permitting by the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, said Councillor Kim Scott, who represents the District 5 community. The kayak launch project is located within 25 feet of a riverfront area and 100 feet of a wetland buffer. The gangway and dock is located within the Concord River, which is a special flood hazard area. These factors require DEP review and approval. Bowman Consulting Group, which is working with the city as a consultant on the project, submitted the DEP application in December 2024. DEP approved the project's Chapter 91 license November 14th. The oldest program of its kind in the nation, Chapter 91, regulates activities of both coastal and inland waterways, including construction, dredging, and filling in tidelands, great ponds, and certain rivers and streams. The Department of Environmental Protection hereby issues the above-referenced waterways license enclosed, authorizing the licensee to perform certain activities pursuant to MGLC 91, the Public Waterfronts Act, and the Waterways Regulations at 310 CMR 9.000. DEP said in a letter addressed to Jorge Martinez, the Urban Renewal Project Manager in Lowell's Department of Planning and Development. Muldoon Park lies along the Concord River, a 15-mile waterway that starts in Concord, formed from the confluence of the Sudbury and Assabet Rivers, and empties into the Merrimack River in Lowell. The boat launch at 5 Billerica Street opens up a part of the historic waterway to the modern-day recreational boater. It's an outdoor improvement that Scott first proposed at a city council meeting in 2022. Her motion requested City Manager Tom Golden work with DPD to develop a plan for implementation of an Americans with Disabilities Act compliant canoe and kayak launch at the park. The project was budgeted for $500,000 of capital funds. The purpose of the project is to provide public access for recreational kayak usage on the river. The ADA accessible walkway will run from the existing parking lot to the proposed gangway and the ADA accessible dock and kayak launch. A schematic of the plan includes a concrete walk and overlook area with benches. Area anglers will also be able to access the dock through the gangway. A landscaping plan calls for selective clearing of invasive species along the river's shoreline. Bowman Project Manager Stephanie McDonald called the redevelopment of the existing park limited. The existing park area remains the same, she told the Conservation Committee last January. We're tying into the existing paved walkway and adding an ADA accessible ramp to the proposed gangway and dock. The gangway and the dock float are designed to float on top of the water and will be mounted to the side of the embankment. The existing sidewalks will be regraded that will lead to the accessible dock. Residents and visitors will be able to put in at the Muldoon Park and paddle out along the same waterway traveled by the well-known naturalist and essayist Henry David Thoreau. He memorialized a trip in the 1849 book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers. The parking lot will remain in the same with 16 spaces, including two handicap spots. Sealed bids will be opened in the purchasing department of the City Hall on January 15th. And on the inside, local news. Flu season. Officials warn that children are hard hit by the flu. We are very concerned about the severity of illness. By Grace Sakovich. Boston reported two children have died related to the flu this season Tuesday, the first pediatric flu-associated deaths in the city since 2013, bringing total related deaths to Massachusetts children up to four. We've noted a dramatic increase in flu cases in Boston, particularly among children, and we're very concerned about the severity of illnesses we've noted among children this season, said Bizola Ojakutu, Boston's Commissioner of Public Health. Tragically, two children under 2 years of age have died from flu-associated illness thus far in Boston. Boston saw a 126% jump in confirmed flu cases in the most recently reported week ending December 27th, the Boston Public Health Commission, BPHC, reported, and hospitalizations nearly tripled. Among children under 5, there was a 142% increase in confirmed flu cases in the last 2 weeks of December. Ojakutu said, emergency department visits for young children grew 125%, and hospitalization almost tripled in the same time frame. Compared to last year, we've noted twice as many kids who've been hospitalized for the flu this season, said Ojakutu. And the number of hospitalizations among children under 5 this season has actually already exceeded last season's hospitalizations at the peak of the season, and we're nowhere near our peak yet. The Boston Commission's announcement comes a day after Massachusetts reported 3 pediatric deaths from flu-related illnesses. Massachusetts reported one of the deaths in Boston, while the other was confirmed overnight, BPHC said. The state has reported 30 confirmed flu-related deaths on its flu dashboard. The deaths come amid a surge of a new FluVax variant, H3N2 subclade K, which is spread across the U.S. and other countries. The variant is behaving in a more aggressive way, Ojakutu said, contributing to an early surge this season. Though the flu vaccine is not a perfect match for the variant, health officials have emphasized getting vaccinated remains vital. Data shows this year's vaccination will decrease the risk of serious illness, hospitalization, and death, Ojakutu said. It's not too late to vaccinate your children, Ojakutu said. Everybody 6 months of age and older is eligible to receive an annual flu vaccination in our state. Please vaccinate your children as soon as they are eligible. There has been a lot of misinformation related to delaying vaccination in children. It is safe to vaccinate children as soon as they are eligible. The flu vaccine is safe, effective, and it saves lives. Only 32.5% of Boston residents have received a flu shot this year, the commissioner said, and 34% across the state. Rate of vaccination amongst all residents, and if you compare that to the state, we're lagging behind slightly. Across the state of Massachusetts, about 34% of residents have been vaccinated. In response to the deaths, a major part of the city's plan is to offer at least 6 additional vaccination clinics for all age groups in January, Ojakutu said. The free clinics will start on Wednesday at City Hall from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. and will continue across the city with no appointments or identification cards needed. And from New Hampshire, Ice Castles, It's a Wonderland, New Hampshire destination open for the season by Danielle Ray. North Woodstock, New Hampshire. The wait is over for the return of Ice Castles to the White Mountains region, the family-friendly destination up north that has been bringing winter fairy tales to life since its inception in 2011. According to a press release, crews worked around the clock over the Christmas holidays to put the finishing touches on this year's castle. The December 27th opening marks the earliest opening date ever for the Ice Castles, located at 24 Clark Farm Road in North Woodstock, one of 5 locations around the country, and the only one on the East Coast. We are excited to open the icy gates in our cherished North Woodstock community with a historic December debut, said Ice Castle CEO Kyle Standiford. Celebrating 15 years, we're proud to celebrate, to welcome guests into a beautifully crafted ice castle filled with winter magic over the holiday season. Founder Brent Christensen developed the patented processes used to create ice castles while building a winter playground for his kids in the front yard of their home in Utah. The project drew crowds who came out to tour Christensen's frozen creation, and since then, as a result, Ice Castles has turned into an internationally renowned tourist attraction with multiple locations across North America. Guests are able to step into a world of wonder at the New Hampshire spot, exploring a landscape filled with ice slides, towers, tunnels, and caverns. The experience features stunning new sculptures crafted by internationally renowned ice sculptors with the thrill of the Tubing Hill and enhanced features on its Mystic Light Walk, and Sleigh Ride Trail. The Ice Fortress also features a frosty twist with the Frozen Tap Ice Bar, the coolest spot in town to enjoy beverages in a one-of-a-kind ice bar experience. And guests can also warm up with hot drinks and indulgent sweet treats available at on-site concessions. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit icecastles.com. In a crime story from Tewksbury, teen arrested after armed home robbery. Police say 15-year-old fled after struggle, firearm later recovered. A 15-year-old Lawrence boy has been arrested after police said he attempted to rob a Tewksbury resident inside their home during the early morning hours Friday. Tewksbury Police Department said the investigators learned that the juvenile went to the victim's home at 1 a.m., displayed a firearm, and demanded money. A struggle ensued, and the suspect fled in a white Audi. Suspect and the victim knew each other, according to the police. With assistance from the Lawrence Police Department, the Tewksbury police executed an arrest warrant at the teen's Lawrence home on Sunday. He was taken into custody after without incident. A search of the residence later uncovered a handgun and multiple rounds of ammunition. The identity of the suspect was not revealed due to his status as a juvenile. The teen is charged with crime, with attempt to commit a crime, armed robbery, two counts of assault and battery, and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. He was scheduled to be arraigned on Monday in Lowell Juvenile Court. Because the case involves a minor, the proceedings in Lowell Junior Court will not be open to the public. A couple short ones from the 5-minute read. There was a lotto winner in Lowell. Juan Diaz Mendez of Lowell is a winner of $2 million grand prize in Massachusetts State Lottery's $2 million 50X cash word instant ticket game. Diaz Mendez opted to receive his prize in the form of a one-time payment of $1.3 million before taxes. He plans on helping his family and investing his winnings. He purchased his winning ticket at Mobile 785 Gorham Street in Lowell. Store receives a $20,000 bonus for a sale of the ticket. The $2 million 50X cash word instant prize includes four more grand prizes of $2 million. Library Book Bin. The Friends of the J.V. Fletcher Library's Book Donation Bin at First Parish Church, United, 48 Main Street, will be located just inside the front entrance of the church's Fellowship Hall. Donations can be dropped off Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 1:30 p.m. Friends are grateful to First Parish for providing indoor space for the bin, as this will keep volunteers, book donors, and donated materials safe and dry. Proceeds from the sale of these donated books immediate at periodic book sales allow the allow the Friends to fund the programs and initiatives library patrons enjoy. The next book sale is slated to take place in the spring. The J.V. Fletcher Library is in the midst of a major expansion and renovation project, slated to be completed in early 2027. While the building is under construction, the library is open in its temporary location at 515 Groton Road near Ace Hardware. Election update for state Senate seat. There will be no in-person early voting for the special state primary Tuesday, February 3rd, or the general election on Tuesday, March 3rd. Voters wishing to apply by mail need to apply soon. In October, state senator Edward Kennedy passed away, leaving a vacancy in the 1st Middlesex District, which includes Dragut, Dunstable, Lowell, Pepperell, and Tingsboro. Saturday, January 24th, last day to register to vote for the state primary on February 3rd. Tuesday, January 27th, last day to apply for a mail-in ballot for the state primary on February 3rd. Saturday, February 21st, last day to register to vote for general election on March 3rd. Tuesday, February 24th, last day to apply for a mail-in ballot for the general election on March 3rd. And there is also two more short stories here from the 5-minute read. Taffeta Music Hall event, Boldy James featuring Joe Sazza, DJ Lucas, and PH Imbalance takes the stage Saturday, January 10th at the Taffeta Music Hall, 110 Western Avenue. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. with an 8:30 p.m. showtime. Tickets for this rap hip-hop show are $25 in advance, $30 day of, and $50 for VIP meet and greet. Concert goers under 18 must be accompanied by parent or guardian. Save the Date PCA concert, the Parish Center for the Arts is in Westford. The Parish Center for the Arts welcomes local favorite Suzanne Buell on Saturday, January 17th at 7:30 to 10 p.m., 10 Lincoln Street. Tickets range from $20 to $22. Seating is cabaret style. Ticket holders should bring their own beverages and snacks. Doors open a half hour before showtime. Buell's Gospel Connection is a musical event that showcases traditional spirituals and gospel music, as well as its connection to the civil rights movement and modern day artists. Seven-piece band includes David Hunt on keyboards and vocals, Phil Antoniadis on drums and percussion, Mike Payette on bass and vocals, Chris Ledbetter on guitar, mandolins and vocals, Vicky Selsky on vocals, Russell Watts on vocals, and Buell on lead vocals. The ensemble will perform music by artists such as Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Mavis Staples, Aretha Franklin, and Bob Dylan. The PCA is a member-driven nonprofit whose mission is to promote community participation in the visual and performing arts. To reserve tickets or for more information, visit parisharts.square.site. Call 978-692-6333. And continuing with some national stories inside here. From Minneapolis, ICE officer kills a Minneapolis driver in a deadly start to Trump's latest immigration operation. By the Associated Press. An immigration customs enforcement officer shot and killed a Minneapolis driver on Wednesday during Trump administration's latest immigration crackdown on a major American city. Shooting that federal official said was an act of self-defense, but that the mayor described as reckless and unnecessary. 37-year-old woman was shot in the head in front of a family member in a snowy residential neighborhood south of downtown Minneapolis, just a few blocks from some of the oldest immigrant markets and about a mile, 1.6 kilometers, from where George Floyd was killed by police in 2020. Her killing after 9:30 a.m. was recorded on video by witnesses, and the shooting quickly drew a crowd of hundreds of angry protesters. By evening, hundreds were there for a vigil to mourn the death and urge the public to resist immigration enforcers. Homeland Security's Secretary Kristi Noem, while visiting Texas, described the incident as an act of domestic terrorism carried out against ICE officers by a woman who attempted to run them over and ram them with her vehicle. An officer of ours acted quickly and defensively, shot to protect himself and the people around him. In a social media post, President Donald Trump made similar accusations against the woman and defended ICE's work. Hours later, at an evening news conference in Minnesota, Noem didn't back down, claiming that woman was part of a mob of agitators. Any loss of life is tragedy, and I think all of us can agree that in this situation, it was preventable, Noem said, adding that the FBI would investigate. But Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey blasted Noem's version of what happened as garbage and criticized the federal deployment of more than 2,000 officers to the twin cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul as part of the immigration crackdown. What they are doing is not going to provide safety in America. What they are doing is causing chaos and distrust, Frey said, calling on the immigration agents to leave. They're ripping families apart. They're sowing chaos on our streets. And in this case, quite literally killing people. They are already trying to spin this as an act of self-defense. Having seen the video myself, I want to tell everybody directly that this is bull blank, the mayor said. Frey said he had a message for ICE. Get the F out of Minneapolis. Videos taken by bystanders with different vantage points and posted to social media show an officer approaching an SUV stopped across the middle of the road, demanding the driver open the door and grabbing the handle. The Honda pilot begins to pull forward, and a different ICE officer standing in front of the vehicle pulls his weapon and immediately fires at least two shots into the vehicle at close range, jumping back as the vehicle moves towards him. It was not clear from the videos that the vehicle made contact with the officer. The SUV then sped into two cars parked on a curb nearby before crashing to a stop. Witnesses screamed obscenities, expressing shock at what they'd seen. After the shooting, emergency medical technicians tried to administer aid to the woman. She was driving away and they killed her, said resident Lynette Ryan Grandel, who was outdoors recording video on her phone. The shooting marked a dramatic escalation of the latest in a series of immigration enforcement operations in major cities under Trump administration. The death of the Minneapolis driver, whose name wasn't immediately released, was at least the fifth incident linked to immigration crackdowns. The Twin Cities have been on edge since DHS announced Tuesday that it launched the operation, which is at least partly tied to allegations of fraud involving Somali residents. Noem confirmed Wednesday that DHS had deployed more than 2,000 officers to the area and said that they had already made hundreds and hundreds of arrests. A large throng of protesters gathered at the scene after the shooting, where they vented their anger at the local and federal officers who were there. including Gregory Bovino, senior U.S. Customs and Border Patrol official, who has been the face of crackdowns in Los Angeles, Chicago, and elsewhere. In a scene that harkened back to the Los Angeles and Chicago crackdowns, bystanders heckled the officers, chanting shame, 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 ICE out of Minnesota, and blue whistles that had become ubiquitous during the operations. Minneapolis Governor Tim Walz said he's prepared to deploy the National Guard if necessary. He said a family member of the driver was there to witness the killing, which he described as predictable and avoidable. He also said that like many, he was outraged by the shooting, but he called on people to keep the peace, protests peaceful. They want a change. I'm sorry. They want a show. We can't give it to them. We cannot, the governor said during a news conference. If you protest and express your First Amendment rights, please do so peacefully, as you always do. We can't give them what they want. Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara briefly described the shooting to reporters, but unlike federal officials, gave no indication that the driver was trying to harm anyone. This woman was in her vehicle and was blocking the roadway on Portland Avenue. At some point, a federal law enforcement officer approached her on foot, and the vehicle began to drive off, the chief said. At least two shots were fired. The vehicle then crashed on the other side of the roadway. There were calls on social media to prosecute the officer who shot the driver. Commissioner Bob Jacobson of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety said the state authorities would investigate the shooting with federal authorities. Keep in mind that this is an investigation that is also in its infancy. So any speculation about what has happened would be just that, Jacobson told reporters. The shooting happened in the district of Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar, who called it state violence, not law enforcement. But for nearly a year, migrant rights advocates and neighborhood activists across the Twin Cities have been preparing to mobilize in the event of an immigration enforcement surge. From houses of worship to mobile home parks, they have set up very active online networks, scanned license plates for possible federal vehicles, and bought whistles and other noise-making devices to alert neighborhoods of an enforcement presence. And from Los Angeles, attorney for Rob Reiner's son resigns. Andrew Dalton, the high-profile private attorney for Nick Reiner, was granted a request to be removed from his case Wednesday. But later, reporters told that according to California law, his client is not guilty of murder in the killing of his parents, Rob Reiner and Michelle Singer Reiner. Circumstances beyond our control, and more importantly, circumstances beyond Nick's control, have dictated that, sadly, it's made it impossible to continue our representation of Nick, lawyer Alan Jackson said as he stood with his team outside a Los Angeles courthouse. But Jackson added, after weeks of investigation, what we've learned and what you can take this, and you can take this to the bank, is that pursuant to the laws of the state, pursuant to the law of California, Nick Reiner is not guilty of murder. Print that. Jackson would not specify what he meant and took no questions at the brief news conference. He spoke after a hearing where Nick Reiner was supposed to be arraigned and enter a plea of two charges of first-degree murder. Instead, after meeting with Judge Teresa McGovern in chambers, Jackson was replaced by public defender and Reiner's plea hearing was postponed to February 23rd. Alan Jackson can't say why he has had to quit the case. Jackson said that for legal and ethical reasons, he could not reveal why he had to leave the case. He first appeared in court representing Reiner at a hearing a few days after the beloved actor, director, and his wife, 36 years, were found dead with stab wounds in their home in the upscale Brentwood section of Los Angeles. Jackson did not say how he was hired or who hired him. Generally, defendants use public defenders when they can't pay for a private attorney. Jackson has become one of the most prominent defense attorneys in the nation in recent years, after defending clients including Harvey Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, and Karen Reed at her intensely followed trial in Massachusetts. After the judge granted Jackson's request to leave the case, Deputy Public Defender Kimberly Green took over as Reiner's attorney. Public Defender's Office recognized what an unimaginable tragedy this is for the Reiner family and the Los Angeles community, Deputy Public Defender Ricardo D. Garcia said in a rare public statement on a case from the office. Our hearts go out to the Reiner family as they navigate this difficult time. We ask for your patience and compassion as the case moves through the legal process. During Wednesday's hearing, Reiner stood behind glass in a custody area of the courtroom, wearing brown jail garb and with his hair shaved. Two deputies stood behind him. Jackson and his team stood in front of him on the other side of the glass. At one point, Reiner stood on his tiptoes to peer over the lawyers' heads to look at the audience. He spoke only to agree to the delayed arraignment. Conigal approved the use of cameras inside the courtroom, but said pictures could not be taken of the defendant. At Wednesday's hearing, Reiner did not wear the suicide prevention smock he had on at his initial court appearance on December 17th. Reiner, 32, the third of Reiner's four children, has been held without bail since his arrest hours after his parents were found dead on December 14th. A Reiner family spokesperson said in a statement after Wednesday's hearing that they have the utmost trust in the legal process and will not comment further on matters related to the legal proceedings. Jackson, a former L.A. County prosecutor, had given no indications of plans for his defense. He said they remain deeply, deeply committed to him and said that we're not just convinced, we know that the legal process will reveal the true facts. And moving inside for more national stories in the Lowell Sun, we have in Florida, DeSantis seeks special session on redistricting. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says Wednesday plans to call a special session in April for the Republican-dominated legislature to draw new congressional districts, joining a redistricting arms race among states that have redrawn districts mid-decade. Even though Florida's 2026 legislative session starts next week, DeSantis says he wanted to wait for a possible ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court on a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. The ruling in Louisiana versus Calais could determine whether Section 2, a part of the Voting Rights Act that bars discrimination in the voting system, is constitutional. Congressional districts in Florida that are redrawn to favor Republicans could carry big consequences for President Donald Trump's plan to reshape congressional districts in GOP-led states, which gave Republicans a shot at winning additional seats in the midterm elections and retaining control of the closely divided U.S. House. In Syria, civilians flee Aleppo as clashes escalate. Fighting escalated in Syria's northern city of Aleppo on Wednesday after tens of thousands of residents fled to predominantly ethnic Kurdish neighborhoods when the military ordered civilians to evacuate the area. The evacuations came amid the deadliest round of recent violence between government forces and Kurdish fighters. Syria's military gave people until 3 p.m. to leave the neighborhood of Sheikh Mosque Skoud and Akrafia, after which they would be considered a closed military area. Once the deadline ended, sounds of explosions were heard in the two neighborhoods. Excuse me. More than 46,000 people have been displaced in different areas of the province, according to Aleppo's Directorate of Social Affairs and Labor. Clashes and shelling earlier on Wednesday killed seven people in areas controlled by the Kurdish-led and U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, and five others in the government-controlled areas. Israeli bus runs over and kills Orthodox teen in Jerusalem. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu urged calm on Wednesday after a bus driver ran over and killed a teenage boy during a protest by thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jewish demonstrators against a law seeking to draft them into Israel's military. I call for restraints to prevent the mood from becoming further inflamed so that, heaven forbid, we do not have additional tragedies, Netanyahu said in a statement, adding that the death would be thoroughly investigated. The incident on Tuesday evening killed yeshiva student Yosef Eisenthal, who police said was 14. Video from the protest obtained by the Associated Press shows the boy being trapped under the vehicle while the driver continued to drive on for several meters as onlookers jostled and screamed. Police officers arrested and questioned the bus driver, who told investigators he was attacked by protesters before his vehicle hit the boy. Bolsonaro leaves Brazilian prison after fall from bed. Former President Jair Bolsonaro on Wednesday temporarily left a prison in Brazil's capital, where he's serving a 27-year sentence for a coup attempt, for medical examination in a local hospital after he fell from his bed. Police escorted the 70-year-old Bolsonaro from the federal police headquarters in Brasilia to the nearby DF Star Hospital, where he arrived around midday for 3 brain tests. It wasn't immediately clear how long the exams would take and when he would return to prison. Bolsonaro fell in his cell overnight from Monday to Tuesday while sleeping. His wife Michelle and his son Carlos said on social media that the far-right politician needed medical attention and expressed frustration that Bolsonaro wasn't sent to the hospital the day after his fall. In his decision authorizing the trip to the hospital Wednesday, Supreme Court Justice Alexander de Moraes cited a health report conducted by the federal police on Tuesday. It's kind of interesting. You can go to jail in Brazil for a coup, but not in the United States. 4 killed in clashes with a gold mining company in northern Afghanistan. Deadly clashes between local residents and operators of a gold mining company in northern Afghanistan left 4 people dead and 5 others injured, officials said Wednesday. Abdul Mateen Kane, a spokesperson for the Interior Ministry, said that violence erupted Tuesday in Shah Ab district of Takhar province, killing 3 residents and 1 company employee. 5 others were wounded. Kane did not specify what triggered the clashes or who owns the company. In a statement, Kane said 2 suspects, 1 a company security employee and the other local resident, have been arrested in connection with the violence. He said security forces quickly restored order and the deputy governor of Takhar had also visited the district to assess the situation. The company's operations have been suspended. Another international story, or national story, Petro's clash with Trump backs Colombia into a corner. This is from the Associated Press. An abhorrent violation of Latin American sovereignty, an attack committed by enslavers, a spectacle of death comparable to Nazi Germany's 1937 carpet bombing of Guernica, Spain. There is perhaps no world leader criticizing the Trump administration's attack on Venezuela as strongly as left-wing President Gustavo Petro of neighboring Colombia. While other officials tread carefully, Petro has seized on the U.S. capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to escalate his spiraling war of words with President Donald Trump, who has said a U.S. military operation in Colombia sounds good to me, and Greenland, and Panama, and Iran. On Wednesday, Petro called for Colombians to take to the streets to stand up for their nation's sovereignty in response to Trump's insults and military intervention threats. He convened emergency meetings before the United Nations and the Organization of American States. And the former leftist guerrilla even threatened to take up arms against the United States to defend his country. Petro's high stakes gambit has put Colombia, long America's staunchest regional ally, in Trump's crosshairs and his government in a bind. How to reap the political rewards of standing up to Washington just months before a presidential election without jeopardizing a crucial security assistant or goading Trump into making good on his threats to invade. That tension was on split screen display this week as Petro lashed out at Trump while his top officials rushed to reassure the U.S. that Colombia remains the pillar of its counter-narcotics strategy abroad. For the past 30 years, the U.S. has worked closely with Colombia, the world's largest producer of cocaine, to arrest drug traffickers, fend off rebel groups, and boost economic development. Colombia retains leverage as a main source of intelligence Washington uses to interdict drugs in the Caribbean, experts say. People are trying to tell Trump, look, you can punish Petro to the extent possible, but you can't want to punish the country. But you don't want to punish the country. That undermines the fight against drugs and is going to be harmful for the United States, said Michael Shifter, a Latin American expert at the Inter-American Dialogue think tank in Washington. But Trump is completely unpredictable, Shifter said. He changes. His mind is driven by his own impulses. Petro has drawn Trump's ire for months. He has turned back U.S. military deportation flights, urged American soldiers to disobey Trump during a pro-Palestinian rally in New York, lambasted U.S. attacks on alleged drug vessels as murder, and sparred with him over Israel's military campaign in Gaza and his administration's crackdown on immigration. Infuriated, Trump has deployed language that he often used to describe Maduro, calling Petro a lunatic and an international drug dealer. He has revoked Petro's U.S. visa, slapped sweeping sanctions on him, his relatives and his interior minister on drug-related grounds, vowed to end all U.S. aid to Colombia, and threatened punitive tariffs on Colombian exports. Thrilled by Maduro's ouster, Trump pushed the fight even further in recent days. He called Petro a sick man who likes making cocaine and selling it to the United States, and warned of a possible U.S. military operation on Colombian soil. Petro can't help relishing the conflict, as long as it remains only verbal. frustrated with congressional resistance to his contentious reforms, failing to fulfill his promise of total peace with armed groups, and facing a series of electoral tests, Pedro has found in Trump the perfect foil as he fights for his legacy. He wants a stage where he's the clearest adversary, rhetorically or politically, to the U.S., said Sergio Guzman, a political risk analyst based in Bogota. The Constitution bars Pedro from seeking another term in May's presidential vote, but the country's first leftist president wants his coalition to retain power over the resurgent right that blames his unpopular government for rising crime. Colombia will also hold legislative elections in March. So far, Pedro's strategy of playing David to Trump's Goliath seems to be paying off. As Trump escalated his threats against Colombia this week, even some of Pedro's opponents rushed to his defense. Trump is misinformed, misfocused. His simplistic statements are counterproductive, said Anibal Gaviria, a right-wing presidential hopeful, praising his country's strong democratic institution. Colombia is not Venezuela, nor Cuba, nor Nicaragua. From Today in History. In 1790, President George Washington delivered the first State of the Union address in New York City. In 1815, the last major engagement of the War of 1812 came to an end as U.S. forces defeated the British in the Battle of New Orleans, not having received word of the December signing of a peace treaty. 1867, the U.S. House of Representatives joined the Senate in overriding President Andrew Jackson's veto of the District of Columbia Suffrage Act, giving black men in the nation's capital the right to vote. I hope I read that right. It was Andrew Johnson's veto, not Andrew Jackson. 1964, President Lyndon B. Johnson, in State of the Union address, declared an unconditional war on poverty in America. 1998, Rami Youssef, the mastermind of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, was sentenced in New York to life in prison without the possibility of parole. 2011, U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords was shot and critically wounded when a gunman opened fire as a congresswoman met with constituents in Tucson. Six people were killed, 12 others were injured. Gunman Jared Lee Loeffner was sentenced in 2012 to 7 consecutive life sentences plus 140 years. 2016, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, the world's most wanted drug lord, was captured for a third time by a daring raid by Mexican Marines. 6 months after walking through a tunnel to freedom from a maximum security prison. 2020, Iran struck back at the United States for killing Iran's top military commander, firing missiles at two Iraqi military bases housing American troops. More than 100 U.S. service members were diagnosed traumatic brain injuries later. As Iran braced for a counterattack the same day, the country's Revolutionary Guard shot down a Ukrainian jetliner departing Tehran after apparently mistaking it for a missile, killing all 176 people on board. Tax refunds are coming. Will they be vaporized by inflation? According to Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Santa Claus will continue delivering bundles of joy in the new year to U.S. taxpayers who receive whopping tax refunds during 2026's first half. Some $100 billion will flow from a retroactive tax cut contained in one big, beautiful bill, the act, passed in July. And there are some gifts for corporate America still waiting in Santa's sled as well. Along with cash for consumers, the legislation brings large reductions in corporate taxes. Some think the fiscal effects of all this will be large enough to add half a point to America's GDP growth in the first quarter of 2026. But then there's another more ominous possibility, a new surge of inflation. Price of gold, long understood to be the investor's refuge against deteriorating dollar, is sounding an alarm. It has soared from $2,400 an ounce in January 2025 to $4,400 in December. Will this be different? There's a lot to consider. The story sounds familiar. It's because not long ago, President Joe Biden was doling out generous piles of emergency funds to taxpayers. Price of gold acted mildly and inflation shot through the roof a couple of years later. Now it seems investors may be on higher alert. Of course, there's more to consider. First and perhaps foremost, the Biden administration was dealing with an economy suffering from a pandemic shutdown. The U.S. Treasury and Federal Board were in cahoots. Unheard of quantitative easing had been introduced in an effort to curtail financial panics and protect the U.S. banking system. The Fed was directly purchasing new Treasury debt to the tune of $3.5 trillion. Together, they were printing money to cover the costs. Obviously, some circumstances have changed. In December, the United States had $36 trillion in public debt on the books and holding. Because of President Donald Trump's efforts to gain tariff-fueled revenues and reduce the scope and pace of public sector spending, the nation has just reached an operating point where we're spending less than we take in. According to the Bipartisan Policy Center, the federal government's cumulative deficit for fiscal year 2026 through November was $439 billion, 19% lower than the same time the previous year. Revenues increased by 18% and outlays increased by 1% for fiscal year 2025. This may not last, but at least offers a prospect of less debt and therefore less need to print money and fuel more inflation. If so, why the runaway prices of gold? We must remember that gold is ultimately money, a store of value universally accepted to extinguish debt. It is also the ultimate disaster hedge. When the economies and life itself becomes disrupted, as in the Middle East, Ukraine, Nigeria, Venezuela, people convert assets to gold as they reorganize. There is also a sizable and growing industrial demand for gold to be used in the production of computers and other electronic devices. Taken together, these rising demand forces are pushing the price of gold higher. So will the soon-to-be-received federal bundles of cash be vaporized by inflation? Or will inflation's forces be covered by America's reduced need for printed money? For the next couple of years, at least, I'm betting against surging inflation. But looking further out and considering America has yet to definitively get its fiscal house in order, I fear the printed press will again become a policy tool and inflation will continue to be a constant threat against prosperity. And inside, do some local sports. UML, University of Massachusetts Lowell, ready to battle against number 10, UConn, in hockey. Hockey East Player of the Week, Dylan Bentley, and UMass Lowell will return to Hockey East play this weekend. It won't be easy for the River Hawks, who split a pair of games last week at the Cactus at the Cactus Cup in Palm Springs, California, upsetting Minnesota State 3-1 and then falling to St. Cloud in the title game 3-2. This weekend's opponent is 10th-ranked UConn, 11-5-3, 7-3-1, the highest-ranked Hockey East squad. The Huskies have won four straight. UConn will host Friday's game at 7 p.m. with UML. 7-12-0, 3-6-0, hosting the rematch on Saturday at 7:05 at Song Center. UConn boosts plenty of skill and balance. The Huskies have 9 players who have collected 11 or more points. I see a team that has got good speed and is well-balanced, UML head coach Norm Bazin said. Their speed is very strong. Bentley was named the Hockey East Player of the Week after scoring 2 goals and an assist against Minnesota State and then netting a goal against St. Cloud. The alternate captain has 5 goals in his team's last 3 goals. Let me try that again. The alternate captain has 5 goals in the team's last 3 games and 4 multi-goal games this season. He leads UML with 15 points on 10 goals and 5 assists. Following him in the scoring parade are freshman Dylan Wakely, graduate student and captain Jay Akern, and sophomore Mirko Butizoni. I thought he was arguably our best forward, Bazin said of Bentley's play in California. He's playing some good hockey right now. Bazin said other forwards like Ahern, Wakely, Therwerk, and Lee Parks also played well in California. The Riverhawks weren't able to defend their Cactus Cup championship despite excelling for long stretches. I thought we played really well for 5 or 6 periods. 5 of the 6 periods, Bazin said. I liked the energy. I liked the starts. I liked the fact that we wanted to play with intensity. I thought both goaltending performances were decent. Even after playing an exhibition game after Christmas against Bentley and facing Minnesota State and St. Cloud last week, Bazin feels his team has another level it can get to. Just play connected, he said. Getting back to playing with intensity for 60 to or 65 minutes. The River Hawks have a tough stretch ahead. After facing UConn on Friday and Saturday, UML will battle Boston University twice and then Maine twice before January turns into February. And some news from the world of arts. Warner Brothers rejects Paramount, tells shareholders to stick with Netflix deal. From the Associated Press, Warner Brothers again rejected a takeover bid from Paramount and told shareholders Wednesday to stick with the rival offer from Netflix. Warner's leadership has repeatedly rebuffed Skydance's own Paramount's overtures and urged shareholders just weeks ago to back the sale of its streaming and studio business to Netflix for $72 billion. Paramount, meanwhile, has made efforts to sweeten its $77.9 billion hostile offers for the entire company. Warner Brothers Discovery said Wednesday that its board determined Paramount's offer is not in the best interest of the company or its shareholders. It again recommended shareholders support the Netflix deal. Paramount's offer continues to provide insufficient value, including terms such as an extraordinary amount of debt financing that creates risks to close and lack of protections for our shareholders if a transaction is not completed, Warner Brothers Discovery Chair Samuel D. Piazza Jr. said in a statement. In contrast, he added, with Netflix will offer superior value at greater levels of certainty. Paramount did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The company's hostile bid is still on the table. Warner shareholders currently have until January 21st to tender their shares. Late last month, Paramount announced an irrevocable personal guarantee from Oracle founder Larry Ellison, who is father of Paramount CEO David Ellison, to back $40.4 billion in equity financing for the company's offer. Paramount also increased its promised payout to shareholders to $5.8 billion if the deal is blocked by regulators, matching Netflix's breakup fee. In its Wednesday letter to shareholders, Warner expressed concerns about a potential deal with Paramount. Warner said it essentially considers the offer a leveraged buyout, which includes a lot of debt, and also pointed to operating restrictions that it said were imposed by Paramount's offer and could hamper WBD's ability to perform throughout a transaction. The battle for Warner and the value of each offer grows complicated because Netflix and Paramount want different things. Netflix's proposed acquisitions include only Warner's studio and streaming business, including its legacy TV and movie production arms and platforms like HBO Max. But Paramount wants the entire company, which, beyond studio and streaming, includes networks like CNN and Discovery. If Netflix is successful, Warner's news and cable operations would be spun off into their own company under a previously announced separation. A merger with either company could take over a year to close and will attract tremendous antitrust scrutiny along the way. Due to its size and potential impact, it will almost certainly trigger a review by the U.S. Justice Department, which could sue to block the transaction or request changes. Other countries and regulators may also challenge the merger, and politics are expected to come into play under President Donald Trump, who has made unprecedented suggestions about his personal involvements on whether a deal will go through. Okay, and more locally, Library Line is cool for kids and adults at Calderwood Pavilion. Adam Theater, Boston's nonprofit professional theater company, dedicated artistically high-quality theater productions that resonate with young audience members, brings its acclaimed play, Library Line, to the Calderwood Pavilion at the Boston Center for the Arts on Tremont Street in the South End for a two-week-plus run from January 10th to the 25th. Based on Michelle Knudsen's best-selling book and directed by Adam, artistic director Rand Betcher, the production features live music and a striking life-size lion puppet created by Jim Henson's Creature Shop. A library lion tells a warm, imaginative story about curiosity, friendship, and when it's okay to bend the rules. The cast includes actors Robert Stroud, Jalen Decklett, Aaron Mankiello, Janice Hudson, and Clara Hevia. Puppeteers operating a life-size lion puppet are Sophia Kaufman, Sydney Grant, and Sarah Nolan. Live music will be performed by the Ori Raz, Tiago Wolf, and Julia Spreti. Adam Theater was established in 2023 with a mission to nurture a lifelong love of theater among children and to celebrate universal values. Becher, who directs the performance, says Library Lion exemplifies the company's imaginative approach to storytelling. The musical play reimagines Knudsen's wise and touching story about friendship and rules, he said. Michelle's wonderful book uses a fantastical idea of a character onto whom others place expectations and preconceptions that get upended, Belcher said. That idea is a basis for so many stories told to children around the globe. It made sense to broaden the book world of Library Lion using these influences. Executive Director Karen Sharav-Zalkin says the group aims to create theater that introduces children to the dilemmas, heroes, obstacles, and friends they encounter in their lives. Theater encourages children to develop empathy and helps them explore and make sense of complex questions and situations that happen in their lives, Zalkin says. It plays Saturday and Sundays, January 10th through 25th, with family-friendly daytime performances. Two school vacation shows on Martin Luther King Day will be held Monday, January 19th. Performance times are Saturday at 2 and 5, Sunday at noon and 3, Monday, January 19th at 11 and 2. Tickets are $45 to $85 and available now at bostontheaterscene.com. In the Wings, Jan Jam at Seacoast Rep, the underground at Seacoast Repertory Theater in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, brings back two of its most popular shows for two shows each for the second annual Jan Jam. Fleetwood Rep kicks things off on Friday, January 9th at 7:30 p.m. and Saturday, January 10th at 2 p.m. with the music of Fleetwood Mac and the solo career of Stevie Nicks. The Underground then shifts gears and blasts off for Galactic Adventure with Mercury Stardust celebrating the music of David Bowie and Queen on Saturday, January 10th and 11th, 7:30. Whether you were there for shows during their first launch or experienced magic for the first time, it will be a weekend to remember. A smattering of art options. As the new year starts, it's time to get serious now that the holidays are over, but everybody's in a stupor, it seems, and there's not a lot going on art-wise. But looking through press releases and on websites, Eye on Art has a couple of things worth looking into this week. The Blues opens tomorrow, January 9th, at the Art Gallery of Lowell All Gallery at 307 Market Street. No other news except it's on through January 31st, and a reception takes place January 24th from 3 to 5. Visit artsleagueoflowell.org. At the Concord Museum, join award-winning journalist Caleb Gale for a conversation about his National Book Award long-listed book, Black Moses, the riveting true story of Edward McCabe, a visionary black leader who sought to establish a self-governed black state in Oklahoma after Reconstruction, and the forces of racism and ambition that stood in his way. The lecture is on Tuesday, January 13th, 7 to 8. Refuge Art School opening. Join the artists at Refuge Art School Tuesday, January 8th, for the opening reception of the New Year's Visual Art and Fashion Show. It's on from 4:30 to 7 p.m. in the mini gallery at 122 Western Avenue in Lowell, and includes a runway show at 5:30 p.m. and visual art by fall semester students at the Refuge. The show continues until early March. Photography show. The Arts League of Lowell has a call for a close to home. It's juried art production show running March 6th to April 26th. What does that mean to be close to home? Is it a physical place? Is it a warm feeling that comes over you when you think of being close to home? Maybe you have a wider vision of home, such as this town you live in, or even the state or the country. Show the juror your photographic vision of being close to home. Entry to this school show is open to all members, news up to date, and non-members. Submitted work must not have been shown previously at the Arts League of Lowell Gallery. Student work done under direct supervision is not eligible. Jeff Kaplan, a fine art photographer and educator who has been creating compelling images with his cameras for over 35 years, is a juror. Work will be juried using digital images entering via an online entry form. Artists may enter one of three photographs. Works chosen must be secure and professionally secure presented. Works must be wired and ready to hang. No sawtooth or keyhole hangers. If your work is not properly prepared to hang, it will be rejected at drop-off, even if previously accepted into the show. And that is it for the Lowell Sun. We will see what we've got in the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. All right, from the Eagle Tribune, Thursday, January 8th. We have on the front page, let's go with some local stuff. In Salem, Labor of Love, Salem Man's Beadwork supports Parkinson's research. Every so often, while making bracelets at the kitchen table, turn workshop in his apartment, Bob Murphy will knock over a cup of beads or slide off his chair onto the floor. Sitting in one position with his feet tucked behind the legs of his chair, they sometimes fall asleep, he said. Before he knows it, he's toppled. Writing himself with advanced Parkinson's disease isn't always easy, but the backlog of bracelets he has to keeps him motivated. It makes people happy, Murphy said. I can't believe the joy I see in people's faces. Taking his time, Murphy, 77, threads different colored beads onto the needler, creating custom patterns for his orders. Hunched over the wooden table, hands trembling, he grips the needler with his right hand, sliding the beads onto an elastic cord with his left, friction slowing him down. Murphy was asked to start making jewelry in June to benefit the Alzheimer's Association as part of the community crafting event at his residence in Salem Woods, an assisted living facility in Salem, where he's lived since 2021. He liked it so much, she decided to take up the hobby to raise money for Parkinson's, a neurological disease that can present as a variety of symptoms, from apathy and anxiety to slow movements and tremors. On December 22nd, Murphy donated $1,500 to Parkinson's Foundation, which the nonprofit promised to match, raising $3,000 for research. I can't imagine what that is in bracelets, said Murphy, who sells them range from $5 to $12 and up to $26 for sets. I've made hundreds of bracelets. I'm sometimes working for 20 hours a day. I've got into a rabbit hole. Since Murphy's diagnosis, the disease has advanced to stage 4, and he now struggles with extreme feelings of anxiety, depression, and apathy. Bracelet making keeps his head away from all of that, he said, and centers his mind with repetitive motions while also serving as a form of occupational therapy. Bob does not let his disability represent who he is as a person, said Ashley Gallo, per diem nurse at the assisted living facility. He's the type of person that will walk over to the senior center, even though he can barely walk. He goes on target trips, he runs bingo, and plays poker with his friends. And this has kept him very social. Alex Gallo's daughter, Ava, 13, and her friend, London Clancy, 12, help Murphy make his bracelets for an hour every Monday, Gallo said. They thread the beads, tie off the knots, and add their own flair to his designs. The bracelets are displayed at inside the entrance of the assisted living facility and for sale at the front desk. Confiding in Gallo, Murphy once told her that the day he stops using his legs, that's when everything will start to go downhill for him. Stage 4 means you're not in a wheelchair. You're not sucking through a straw, but you're getting ready, Murphy said. So I fight every day, and the bracelets help me do that. Reading helps me do that. Puzzles help me do that. It's something you don't die from, you die with, he said. And there we go. Middleton fire, jail fire displaces 407 inmates. Inmate visits at Middleton Jail are canceled until at least next week, and some inmates are being held in Middlesex County after a transformer fire and housing caused extensive damage. Some 407 inmates, more than half of the inmates at Middleton Jail right now, were relocated to other areas of Manning Avenue facility after 6:30 p.m. fire Tuesday night. Other inmates were moved to the Middlesex County Sheriff Department facilities. Essex County Sheriff Kevin Coppinger said other county sheriff's officers throughout the state have offered bed space if necessary. Electrical crews were working into Wednesday night assessing the extensive damage caused by the electrical explosion and fire. The cause of the fire is believed to be accidental, and Coppinger said a new large generator was delivered to the jail late Wednesday afternoon. He praised both sheriff department workers and inmates for their response to the emergency Tuesday night. Coppinger said the inmates were initially rushed outside into a yard at the jail and then housed in other buildings. It could have been worse, he said. There are 775 inmates at Middleton Jail Tuesday night. The building where the fire ignited is the largest housing unit. The jail, built in 1990, has a maximum capacity of roughly 1,250 inmates. Coppinger said attorneys may continue to meet with clients on site at Middleton Jail, though delays are possible. Additional Essex County Sheriff's Department personnel are on duty to ensure the safety and security of inmates and staff. Jail staff undergo disaster and emergency preparedness training, he said. Inmates have tablets they can use to stay in touch with relatives. In-person visits will likely be reinstated Monday, Coppinger said. The explosion appears to have occurred in an underground conduit connecting an external transformer to an internal breaker panel in the 240 building. One inmate was taken to Beverly Hospital where he was treated and released. Coppinger said the inmate was on the phone, a landline, and feared he might have been shocked during the incident. The 240 building sustained significant electrical damages and remains without power. Officials expect the assessment process to take several days before determining when the building can be safely brought back online, Coppinger said. The issues with the fire are contained to jail property, and there is no need for the general public to worry, he said. The Middleton Fire Department extinguished the fire quickly and was supported with firefighter personnel and equipment from surrounding communities. The safety and security of everybody at Essex County Sheriff's Department facilities is my top priority, Coppinger said. While this is a complex situation, it is well under control thanks to the professionalism of our officers and staff. I also want to thank my fellow officer sheriffs for their offers of assistance, as well as the Middleton Electric and Fire Department personnel for their continued support. In Boston, Pamela Smart seeks to overturn conviction for involvement in her husband's murder. It's an old story, old event, I guess. Pamela Smart, who was serving life in prison for orchestrating the murder of her husband by her teenage student in 1990, seeking to overturn her conviction over what her lawyers claim were several constitutional violations. The petition for habeas corpus relief was filed Monday in New York, where she is being held in Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women, and in New Hampshire, where the murder happened. Ms. Smart's trial unfolded in an environment that no court had previously confronted. Wall-to-wall media coverage that blurred the line between allegation and evidence, Jason Ott, who is part of Smart's legal team, said in a statement. This petition challenges whether a fair adversarial process took place. The move comes about 7 months after New Hampshire Governor Kelly Ayotte rejected a request for a sentence reduction hearing. Ayotte said she reviewed the case and decided it was not deserving of a hearing. Spokesperson for New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Spokesperson for New Hampshire's Attorney General said it would not comment on pending litigation, other than to note that the state maintains Ms. Smart received a fair trial and that her convictions were lawfully obtained and upheld on appeal. In their petition, lawyers for the 57-year-old Smart argue that prosecutors misled the jury by providing them with inaccurate transcripts of surreptitiously recorded conversation of Ms. Smart that include words that were not audible on the recording. Among the words they claim were audible but in a transcript were the word killed in the sentence, you had your husband killed. The word busted in the sentence, I'm going to be busted, and the word murder in the sentence, this would have been the perfect murder. Modern science confirms what public's common sense has already told us. When people are handed a script, they inevitably hear the words they are shown. Smart Stewart, Matthew Zernheld, said in a statement, jurors were not evaluating the recordings independently. They were being directed towards a conclusion. In that direction, decided the verdict. Lawyers also argued the conviction should be overturned because the verdict was tainted by media attention and due to faulty instructions to the jury. They argued jurors were told they must find Smart acted with premeditation, not told they must consider only evidence presented at trial. They also argued that the trial court gave her a mandatory life sentence without parole for being an accomplice to first-degree murder, despite New Hampshire not mandating that sentence for the charge. Smart was a 22-year-old high school media coordinator when she had an affair with a 15-year-old boy who later fatally shot her husband, Gregory Smart, in Derry. Shooter was freed in 2015 after serving a 25-year conviction, a 25-year sentence. Although Smart denied knowledge of the plot, she was convicted of being an accomplice to first-degree murder and other crimes and sentenced to life without parole. Took until 2024 for Smart to take full responsibility for her husband's death. In a video released in June, she said she spent years deflecting blame almost as if it were a coping mechanism. Smart's trial was a media circus and one of America's first high-profile cases about a sexual affair between a school employee and a student. Student William Flynn testified that Smart told him she needed her husband killed because she feared she would lose everything if they divorced and that she threatened to break up with him if he didn't kill her husband. Flynn and three other teens cooperated with prosecutors and all had been released. Flynn and 17-year-old Patrick Randall entered the Smart's Derry condominium and forced Gregory Smart to his knees in the foyer. As Randall held a knife to the man's throat, Flynn fired a point-hollow bullet into his head. Both pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and were sentenced to 28 years to life. They were granted parole in 2015. Two other teenagers served prison sentences and have been released. The case inspired Joyce Maynard's 1992 book To Die For and the 1995 film of the same name, starring Nicole Kidman and Joaquin Phoenix. Remember that movie? Long time ago. From the editorial page of the Lawrence Tribune, a letter to the editor by Paul Mendelson of Newburyport. Hail to the bully-in-chief. After all his bluster, Trump has followed through with his threats to Maduro and Venezuela, legal or not. We should be alarmed by his brash and grandiose behavior. Yet this is nothing new. Think Korea, Vietnam, Grenada, Iraq, Afghanistan. However, there is something new. We have never had such an inept and fraudulent leader, so engrossed in his own self-importance, so narcissistic, so bent on self-aggrandizement. While I, like many, am happy to see Maduro go, I am saddened to see how much we have fallen. The USA under Trump is perhaps at its nadir. There will be much Monday morning quarterbacking about this issue. I am particularly upset by a comment Trump made about this operation, calling it something like the largest and greatest invasion in history. How incorrect, how ignorant, how shameful, how insulting of him, when the invasion of Normandy was much larger, much, much more important, and took the lives of so many who served this country and saved Europe and the world from Hitler. And this from a felon who fled the draft many years ago. That was Paul Mendelson of Newburyport. And from John Atherton of Dover, Trump uses redefining power to ignore the law. Trump has redefined weapons of mass destruction to include fentanyl. His redefinition lets him ignore due process so he can bomb foreign nations on the high seas. He offers no evidence whatsoever that the boat people traffic fentanyl. He just made a calm and health. He just made a claim and hellfire missiles rain down. There are no trials, no evidence, no testimony, no lawyers representing the accused. If unimpeded, Trump will repeat his redefining activity wherever he wants, and it grows ever more sinister. The president may well use the same kind of thinking to redefine any person or organization as criminal. This allows him to make outlaws of opposition legislators, uncompliant judges, political parties. The evening news may soon show FBI agents perp-walking lines of shackled senators, judges, and party leaders into custody. Redefining damages are an entire legal system. If redefining words allows government agencies to ignore proof of crime, then they can arrest or kill anybody at any time for any reason. If government agencies can't ignore due process, then they can do whatever they want. Trump uses his redefining power to ignore the law. We have a system of checks and balances. We had, I would say. We have a system of checks and balances to protect us from such an abuse of power. We can't check Trump's unbalanced language, then we should redefine him into a civilian status and return to the rule of law. Let's end with, we will end with a couple stories from Dear Abby. Dear Abby, my husband is battling cancer. He has good days and bad days. He is not at the end, but he can no longer do a lot of things for himself. At this point, we are very busy with doctors and treatments. We have 14 medical treatments this month alone. His children want to visit from out of town frequently. Of course, they want to see their dad, and I understand. However, now, how I can accommodate these visits graciously without discouraging them so the additional responsibility doesn't wear me out. I have tried setting some limits, and some of them pay attention to what I say. However, one child, age 50, doesn't listen. They come to town and want to spend all day with dad. I have to provide meals, snacks, beverages, and attempt to monitor my husband's rest time, as well as my own. I have tried limiting the number of days, but I am ignored. The last time, my husband and I suggested 4 days instead of seven, but we were ignored. Now this child wants to come for a month. Please help. Caretaker in Utah. Caretaker, dear caretaker. That this child would ignore not only your request, but also their father's is terrible. I am sorry you didn't mention where this person stays when they visit, but it should not be in your home. They should stay at a hotel or motel, and they, not you, should be responsible for their meals. Your husband can help with this to some degree. When he's tired and needs to rest, he should be willing to tell his children it's time to go. This child should be willing to lend a hand wherever it's needed, including shopping for groceries, doing laundry, and taking dad to medical appointments. Excuse me, so you can rest. Drawing the line isn't easy, but once it's done, you will both be glad you did. And we will read, I guess we will read one local sports story. So we've got a moment here. No fear factor. Andover's Downey ready to attack the slopes again. From Andover by Jamie Pote. When Reese Downey was 2 years old, her parents, Rick and Lisa, put her on Ski Hill for the first time. From what the Andover High junior remembers and has been told, that never scared her. 8 years later, as a fourth grader, she was part of Gunstock Ski Club and was involved in a serious skiing accident. I was free skiing, someone cut me off, and I landed in the woods hitting a tree. Luckily, she didn't hit her head. I ended up breaking my arm, my leg, and my hand. It was a long recovery. I had to spend 6 weeks in a hospital bed. I had surgery on my leg with rods put in. After that, I spent 6 weeks in a wheelchair. It almost took 7 months to fully recover because a few months later, I got the rods taken out. Just like when she was a toddler, Downey didn't get frightened when she returned to the mountain. I was able to ski the next season. It was a little scary, but at the same time, I trusted myself and became more aware of my surroundings, she said. Now, 7 years after the accident, Downey returns for her third season with the Golden Warriors and is not timid in the least to help Andover improve on his 4-8 season. We're all excited for the season, she said, noting the season opens on Monday. We have a great group of girls on the team. We had our first practice on the snow Monday, and we're ready to get going. This will mark the first time Maurice will compete for Andover without her older sister Brooke by her side. When we joined the Gunstock Ski Club, it was fun because we competed against each other, said Reese. It was fun, but we pushed each other. I always wanted to beat her, and she always wanted to beat me. Brooke almost always won, but I did beat her once my freshman year. Last year in the state championship meet, Reese finished 43rd in slalom, 40th in the giant slalom. The giant slalom is a whopper. It's simpler. When you are free skiing, you make those turns anyway. Slalom requires more talent, work, and practice due to the coordination required by the gates. I'd rather just go fast in the giant slalom rather than making all those turns. And we will read one last little short sports story. Freshman is their lead story from Salem, New Hampshire. Freshman Hawk turns away 52 shots, preserves tie for Timberlake. Salem, New Hampshire. Just how good was Simon Hawks on Wednesday afternoon? The freshman, as he had done a couple times already this year, kept Timberlake Pelham Hockey in it, coming up with a save after acrobatic save, 52 in all. And his Owl teammates took care of the rest, getting to a rock-solid 1-1 overtime tie with Division I foe Portsmouth Newmarket Sanborn. He's just very good goaltender, said Owls coach Bill Brown, whose club is now 1-0-1 in overtime games. He's right in the thick of the Division II standings at 2-4-1 overall. Side-by-side movement, he's always in control of his body, always in position, very calm. He doesn't go one way or the other, too far one way or another. He just plays the position solidly, and he's confident. Each team scored in the second period, with the junior assistant captain Arturo Saldarraga scoring an unassisted goal for the Owls. Outshot 31-15 through two periods, Timberlake was under siege in the third. Hawks just said no, stopping all 16 shots that came his way. I love it. Definitely, said Hawks about the barrage of shots sent his way in this one. I love stopping the puck. I hate the boring games with only a few saves. And Harvey is back on USA Hockey Team, University of Wisconsin. Sensation Caroline Harvey of Salem, New Hampshire, will leave her top-ranked college team to play for the U.S. Team USA at the Olympic Winter Games. Harvey, a senior captain, played for Team USA in the 2022 Beijing Winter Games. She has helped USA win 2 golds and 3 silvers in international competition. Harvey is giving a Player of the Year performance this season with 41 points, second in the nation, while leading the nation with 30 assists as a defenseman. Wisconsin is 18-1-1 this fall and winter, having won 2 of the last 3 national titles. Good for her. Merrimack College has landed a commitment from 2005-born goaltender Lindars Fellberg's, a name that should already resonate with anyone who's followed last year's World Junior Championship carefully. Fellberg was one of the breakout stars of the 2025 World Juniors, and he is now coming to Merrimack College. Thank you. You have been listening to Lowell Associations for the Blind, LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUMLFM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. There are several ways you may listen to LAB Radio. You may request a free specialized radio receiver or get more information about our radio reading service at LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or you may visit our website, where you can tune into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Barry. Thank you very much for listening today. We will talk to you next week. Every week we will try to do better. Have a good weekend.